as our top stories, people around the world mark International Poets Day in support of the Palestinian cause against the Israeli occupation. Major European countries have called on Israel to halt its settlements construction in the occupied West Bank. And India reports a record daily rise in coronavirus cases, more than 414,000, as nearly 4,000 more people die of the pandemic. Welcome to the program. People across the world mark International Poets Day, which falls on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. The occasion is marked in solidarity with the Palestinian nation. People across the world hold rallies to denounce Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. They also denounce Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people in the occupied territories as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. Political and religious leaders shed light on the Palestinian cause and urge Muslim unity against Israel. This year, however, things are different. Quds rallies have been canceled in many countries, including over here in Iran, due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The International Quds Day is an annual event held across the world on the last Friday of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan to show solidarity with the Palestinians and denounce the occupying and usurping Israeli regime. Every year on this day, people from all walks of life hit the streets chanting slogans and carrying banners to call for the freedom of Palestine. The Quds Day rally turned into a global event in 1979 with a call from the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Ayatollah Khomeini declared the last Friday of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan each year as Quds Day, in which Muslims worldwide would unite in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. Ayatollah Khomeini declared the liberation of Jerusalem al-Quds a religious duty to all Muslims. Quds Day has actually become a day for protesters across the world, especially Muslim and Arab countries, to slam Israel's occupation of Palestine and its oppression of the Palestinians. During the First Intifada in January 1988, the Jerusalem Committee of the Organization of the Islamic Conference decided that Quds Day should be commemorated in public events throughout the Arab world. Today, this event is not limited to West Asia, the wider Arab world, or predominantly Muslim countries alone. But Quds Day protests are held in the United Kingdom, Germany, Canada, Sweden, France, the United States, and many Asian, Latin American, and African nations, attended by both Muslim and non-Muslim communities. In fact, Quds Day rallies are now not just to call for the liberation of Palestine and denounce Israeli atrocities, but the legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic has turned into a global movement against aggressors and the solidarity with those under tyranny. Many call it a day when the oppressed should become equipped against the oppressors.
We'll be discussing this issue a little bit further with guests who join us for this part of the program. And Mona Kande, of course, one of them, our correspondent, who has traveled for us, I believe, to Colombia or the other way around. I'm pretty sure that it should be the other way around. If you're in Colombia, talk to me about what you see over there. And later on, before you start, let me just introduce Professor Saad Nemer as well. He's a professor of political science with Birzeit University. He is coming to you live from Ramallah. Mona Kandil in Colombia, tell us what you see there on International Quds Day.
That's right. We are right now at the Colombia military checkpoint. It's to the south of occupied Ramallah, northern Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's supposed the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan and International Quds Day. On the last on Fridays during the last years, it was supposed to witness thousands and sometimes hundreds of Palestinians coming from across the occupied West Bank to enter Jerusalem Al-Quds in order to perform the prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, this year the situation is completely different. Usually Israeli forces and the Israeli authorities require Israeli issued permits, special permits for the Palestinians in order to be able to enter Jerusalem Al-Quds. This time, in addition to the Israeli-issued permits, the Israeli authorities also stipulated that anyone who wants to enter to Jerusalem Al-Quds from the occupied West Bank must have gotten the vaccine for the COVID-19. Palestinians, even with the spread of the coronavirus and the strict measures, they try to reach Qalandia military checkpoint in order to enter Jerusalem Al-Quds. However, they were surprised by these strict measures and they were ordered to leave only few hundreds, maybe, from all across the occupied West Bank who were allowed to enter Jerusalem Al-Quds today. There are also reports that the Israeli authorities would be trying to prevent people from reaching the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem Al-Quds in order to prevent any form of clashes, especially with the issue of what's going on in East Jerusalem Al-Quds and the evacuation of the Palestinian homes there. The Israelis are trying to prevent any clashes between the settlers and the Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. Because last night clashes renewed there with the settlers attacking the Palestinians, refused any compromise and any deal with the Israeli settlers. They insist that they have their right to remain on their land and to stay in their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. So the Israelis don't want for Palestinians from the occupied West Bank to be in Jerusalem Al-Quds on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan to prevent any form of clashes.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Mona Kandil. Please stay with us, Mona. I'm going to get back to you for another question, perhaps, you know, if we have the time. But for now, Professor Saad Nimr, it's International Quds Day. You are in Ramallah yourself. What do you think about, you know, the importance that this day holds in the eyes of of Palestinians, including yourself, Professor, and, you know, how it has contributed perhaps to the spirit of resistance against the, you know, what the Israelis basically have done over the years to the Palestinians?
As a matter of fact, the Jerusalem issue is a very important issue to the Palestinians. And since 1979, when late Ayatollah Khomeini declared that day to be the day of Al-Quds, and this day is being escalated every year, and more people are joining all over the world, not only in Iran or Arab countries, but also around the world. That give us, you know, a huge boost for the Palestinians, especially in the occupied territories. We are seeing now Jerusalem being Jewedized by the Israelis, and they are taking over the holy sites and everywhere in Jerusalem. Because of that, we need the support of the international community. We need the support of all Muslims. By the end of the day, we are, as Palestinians, defending Jerusalem. We are there. We are. It's our duty to defend our city and our holy sites. But at the same time, we know that this holy sites belongs not only to the Palestinians, but to the whole Muslims all over the world. And we believe that Muslims who are in solidarity with the Palestinians today in Jerusalem Day, definitely that will give us a good boost even in Jerusalem or in the West Bank against the settlers and against the Israeli atrocities against the city and the Jewedizing of the city. What we are seeing today, it's a very dangerous period of time for Jerusalem, especially in the last few years and after Trump admitted or recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The Israeli are out of their mind in trying to Jewedize the city in so many different ways. The latest is the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, where 28 houses is going to be evacuated and to be demolished to build a new settlements there. More than 500 people who are living in these 28 houses. This is absolutely outrageous. The whole idea for the Israeli came after the failure of the 2000 Camp David negotiations between late Yasser Arafat and the Israelis over the issue of Jerusalem. And the Israeli realized that the overwhelming majority of the Palestinians who are living in Jerusalem, and they needed to change the demography of Jerusalem. So they came out with the program called 2020. That means that by the year 2020, they should have changed the demography of the city. And ever since 2000 till today, they are trying to do it in so many different ways, but they didn't succeed, as a matter of fact, in evacuating all the Palestinians. What we are witnessing now is a real ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem, where the settlers are taking over the houses of the Palestinians, kicking them out, using not only the all the apparatus of the Israeli government apparatus, but also the courts, which are siding beside the settlers and ruling for their sake to get the houses of the Palestinians and kicking them out. This is, with no doubt, an ethnic cleansing case, which is a war crime against the humanity. What we are now asking the whole international community and the Muslims all over the world in this day, Jerusalem Day, Al-Quds Day, to stand by the Palestinians and to apply all kind of pressure as an international community against Israel to stop all these atrocities against the Palestinians and to stop the violations and the measures taken in Jerusalem and to help the Palestinians in their battle against this Judaization of Jerusalem. All the powers of the people, all the support we can get to help us as Palestinians in doing so. The Palestinians in Jerusalem are doing their best. And last night, there were an attack in Sheikh Jarrah by the settlers against the people who are taking their iftar after the Maghrib prayer. And the Palestinians started also to fight back, and they defeated these settlers who tried to attack them. But this is on a daily basis. We need help, and we need also a big stand by the international community, by the Muslim community all over the world to support the Palestinians in their battle in Jerusalem.
Understandably, Professor, thank you for that comprehensive answer. And, of course, I also spoke to Mona Kandil, our correspondent, in Qalandia, and Professor Saad Nemr in Ramallah. I really appreciate the time that both of you gave us. I don't think I have any time to ask another question from either of you. Thank you very much, and let's just move on to another story. You have a good day. Major European countries have called on Israel to halt its settlement construction in the occupied West Bank. In the joint statement, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Britain urged Tel Aviv to reverse its decision to build 540 settler units in the Har Homa area. The statement says construction of settlements in the area between East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Bethlehem will further damage the prospects for a viable Palestinian state. Palestinian presidential office has welcomed the European reaction and called for continued pressure on Israel to stop its settlements construction. People in the Gaza Strip have held a rally to protest Israel's aggression against Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds, where dozens of them have been forced to leave their homes through Ba Shabbat is in Gaza.
The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces Committee in the Gaza Strip held a protest to support Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem Al-Quds, where dozens of Palestinians are illegally displaced from their homes by force. In a press conference held during the protest, Palestinian leaders called on the international community to end this eviction that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause.
The apartheid policies and the displacement of Palestinians from their land is totally rejected by Palestinians. We stress that we won't allow the Nakba and the land grabbing that happened in 1978 to be repeated again. We are calling on the international community to stop these violations. We also call on all Palestinians to get united in order to end all Israeli conspiracies against Palestine.
Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip expressed solidarity with people in Sheikh Jarrah and held the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of this move. In a recent statement by Hamas military wing, its leader Mohammed Daif warned that Israel will pay a heavy price if attacks against Sheikh Jarrah continue.
The message of the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli regime for these violations against our people is clear. Jerusalem al-Quds is our red line, and the resistance won't allow such crimes to go unpunished. The Israeli occupation will pay the price if the eviction in Jerusalem al-Quds continues.
As observers say, Palestinians are forcibly displaced from Sheikh Jarrah to make way for Jewish settlers. The Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah have been stepping up their campaign to save their families from eviction in recent weeks.
We are supporting our people in Jerusalem al-Quds. The current displacement of Palestinians is totally illegal, as those are the real owners of this land. This move aims to demolish the Palestinian cause and expand the Jewish settlements. The Israeli occupation should be held accountable for these crimes.
Similar rallies have been held by Palestinians against the eviction across occupied lands.
People here stress they are all united in defending Palestinian rights, and they won't remain silent over the illegal displacement of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
And the grim news of the COVID-19 pandemic in India, the stronger and, day by day, it is getting stronger and grimmer. The record now stands at 414,000 new cases. The new figure has pushed India's total cases nearly 21.5 million, the second largest in the world. Bear that in mind. The country's COVID deaths have increased by almost 4,000 to over 234,000. The virus surged in big cities in the past few weeks. Now Indian authorities say it has spread to rural areas. The surge has also caused a health crisis. Hospitals are overwhelmed and struggling with severe shortages of medicines and oxygen supplies. Many states have imposed restrictions, but the government is reluctant to impose a national lockdown due to the economic fallout. And that's it with international news.
و به توفیق الهی امت اسلامی و ملت مسلمان فلسطین بر دشمنان خودشون قطعا پیروز خواهند شد و خواهند دید اون روزی را که ریشه رژیم جعلی صهیونیست از سرزمین فلسطین کنده خواهد شد.
With God's grace and divine providence, the Islamic Ummah and the Palestinian nation will emerge victorious, inflicting a decisive defeat on their enemies. And we shall see the day when the fake Zionist regime will be uprooted once and for all from the land of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
the limelight.
The first-time defender of Donald J. Trump came for Representative Liz Cheney for the offense of having voted to impeach him. Fellow Republicans closed ranks to save her leadership post, with Representative Kevin McCarthy boasting that the Big Tent Party had enough room for both the former president and for a stalwart critic. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nicholas Fandos and Katie Edmondson. The piece is titled, House Republicans Have Had Enough of Liz Cheney's Truth-Telling. First-time defenders of Donald Trump came for Representative Liz Cheney for the offense of having voted to impeach him. Fellow Republicans closed ranks to save her leadership post, with Representative Kevin McCarthy boasting that the Big Tent Party had enough room for both the former president and for a stalwart critic. But evidently, no more. Just 3 months after she beat back a no-confidence vote by lopsided margins, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the number three House Republican, is facing a far more potent challenge that appears increasingly likely to end in her ouster from leadership. This time, Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, is encouraging the effort to replace her. Her transgression, colleagues say, Liz Cheney's continued public criticism of Donald Trump, her denunciation of his lies about a stolen election, and her demands that the GOP tell the truth about how his supporters assaulted democracy during the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. The turnabout reflects anew the passion with which Republicans have embraced Donald Trump and the voters who revere him, and how willing many in the Republican Party are to perpetuate, or at least to tolerate, falsehoods about the 2020 election that Donald Trump has continued to spread. The latest test for Liz Cheney could come as soon as next week, when a growing group of Republicans is planning a fresh bid to dethrone her, with Kevin McCarthy's blessing. Many of her colleagues are now so confident that it will succeed that they are openly discussing who would replace Liz Cheney. The tensions escalated on Tuesday, 4th of May, when Kevin McCarthy went on Donald Trump's favorite news program, Fox and Friends, to question whether Liz Cheney could effectively carry out her role as the party's top messenger. Beforehand, McCarthy had told a Fox Channel reporter, he had said, "I've had it with her, and I've lost confidence," according to a leaked recording of the exchange published by the website Axios. "I have heard from members concerned about her ability to carry out the job as conference chair, to carry out the message," Kevin McCarthy said during the portion of the interview that aired. "We all need to be working as one if we're able to win the majority." With one-time allies closing in, Liz Cheney, known for her steely temperament, has only dug in harder. Minutes after Kevin McCarthy's television hit, she sent her barbed reply through a spokesman, effectively suggesting that the minority leader and Republicans moving against her were complicit in Donald Trump's dissembling. "This is about whether the Republican Party is going to perpetuate lies about the 2020 presidential election, an attempt to whitewash what happened on 6th of January," said Jeremy Adler, the spokesman. "Liz Cheney will not do that. That is the issue." One of the few Republican voices willing to rise for Liz Cheney's defense was Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who has himself come under attack from his party for his unrepentant criticism of Donald Trump, even getting booed at the Utah Republican Party convention on Saturday, 1st of May. "Every person of conscience draws a line beyond which they will not go. Liz Cheney refuses to lie," Mitt Romney wrote on Twitter. "As one of my Republican Senate colleagues said to me following my impeachment vote, I wouldn't want to be a member of a group that punished someone for following their conscience." Many House Republicans insist they have no problem with Liz Cheney's vote to impeach Donald Trump, which she described as a vote of conscience. Nor, they say, are they bothered by her neoconservative policy positions, which skew, like those of her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, toward a hawkishness that is at odds with the America First slant of the party that Donald Trump cemented. But they fear that Liz Cheney's refusal to stop criticizing Donald Trump or condemning the events of 6th of January could weaken the party's message going into the 2022 midterm elections, when they hope to portray Democrats as big government socialists so villainous they should be voted out of the majority. It has also infuriated the former President Donald Trump. Many, including Kevin McCarthy, had hoped that after surviving the February vote of no confidence, Liz Cheney, as an elected leader, would make like the rest of the party and simply move on. Instead, she has doubled down and at times turned her fire on colleagues. The final straw for many came last week in Orlando, Florida, where Republicans gathered for their annual policy retreat in hopes of putting on a show of unity. Liz Cheney told Punchbowl News that she would campaign in Wyoming, where she faces a primary challenge defending her impeachment vote every day of the week. She told reporters that any lawmaker who led the bid to invalidate President Biden's electoral victory in Congress should be disqualified from running for president. And she broke with leading Republicans when she said a proposed independent commission to investigate the 6th of January riot should focus on the attack on the Capitol building by a pro-Trump mob, rather than scrutinizing violence by Antifa and Black Lives Matter movement, as Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans have demanded. Just a few days later, she drew attacks from the right for fist-bumping Joe Biden at his speech before a joint session of Congress, and took to Twitter to defend herself for greeting the president in a civil, respectful, and dignified way. "We're not sworn enemies," she wrote, "we're Americans." On Monday, and after Donald Trump issued a statement calling the 2020 election fraudulent and the big lie, Liz Cheney quickly tweeted her rebuttal, writing that anyone who made such claims was poisoning our democratic system. Some Republicans privately likened her performance to picking at a scab, and many of Mr. Trump's allies saw it as an opening to, again, to try to depose her. "Liz has attempted, and is failing badly, to divide our party," Representative Lance Gooden, a Republican from Texas, wrote on Twitter on Tuesday, emulating Donald Trump's caustic Twitter style. "Trump is still the leader of the GOP, Liz. I look forward to her being removed soon." Liz Cheney's troubles chart a rapid shift for the Republican Party in the few months since Donald Trump left Washington. Early on, she was part of a small but influential group of Republicans that included Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader, and condemned Donald Trump's role in stoking the riot with false claims of a stolen election. But many of those lawmakers have since gone quiet, leaving Liz Cheney, who once was enthusiastically spoken of as a future speaker or future president, she's now very isolated within the Republican Party. Liz Cheney declined through a spokesman to comment, and several of her allies in the House would not speak on the record in her defense, underscoring the fraught nature of the vote and the pessimism some of them feel about her chances of surviving another challenge. A spokeswoman for Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, another Republican who voted to impeach Donald Trump and has been a leading critic of the former president, said in a statement that the congressman unequivocally supports Liz Cheney for conference chair. Those who know her best say privately that Liz Cheney's predicament reflects both her principles and her personality, including a stubborn streak that sometimes prompts her to act against her own self-interest. One ally who has been exasperated by her in recent months described her actions as classic Liz Cheney. She will always do what she thinks is right, the Republican said on Tuesday, but she will just never stop to think that she's wrong.
Debate. Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has expressed concern over the violence that Bahraini security forces have inflicted on prisoners at the Jobe prison in Manama. This after prisoners initiated a peaceful sit-in complaining about their treatment and the neglect of another political prisoner, which led to his death. After more than a decade of protests by the Bahraini people, the regime continues with its brutal attack against the people of this country, both inside of prisons and out.
Protests are growing in Bahrain inside and outside prison walls, so is the regime crackdown. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Office described as disturbing the Bahraini regime's use of force to break up a peaceful sit-in at the country's main prison mid-April. OICHR slammed as unnecessary and disproportionate the violent repression of the sit-in at Jao prison located south of the capital, Manama. The inmates have been demonstrating against detention conditions, particularly the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in started in early April after the death of a political prisoner due to reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. Outside the prison, Bahrainis have been holding similar protests, calling for the release of political prisoners and better conditions. OICHR says the lack of health care in overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, which has turned into a chronic problem due to the coronavirus pandemic. It says Manama's response to protests has been in the form of more detentions. Thousands of opposition politicians, activists, journalists, and human rights defenders have been imprisoned in Western allied Bahrain since an uprising in 2011 and subsequent years of crackdown.
The Bahraini regime has been clamping down very viciously on these political prisoners that have been protesting against appalling conditions in Bahraini prisons. These are, in fact, political prisoners, it's important to emphasize, because these are people that had protested very peacefully back in 2011, demanding political reforms, democratic rights and human rights, and even citizenship rights. They've been protesting not only against the appalling conditions that exist there, but these conditions have been worsened as a consequence of the pandemic.
Bahrain's most prominent cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, says drawing up a new constitution is the only way out of the political crisis. He has urged the regime to pursue an agreement with the opposition instead of increasingly suppressing the dissidents. That advice is likely to fall on deaf ears, given over 10 years of crackdown. However, with every protest chipping away at the legitimacy and authority of the Al-Khalifa regime, it is only fast-tracking the inevitable, which cannot be suppressed.
I'd like to welcome my first guest out of Washington, D.C., author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman. Michael, great to have you with us. Now, Michael, when we look at the situation in Bahrain, I mean, what is it about the regime? Why is the regime so repressive against the people there? What is it trying to get to?
Well, it's trying desperately to hold on to power, and it's been backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States since the beginning of the protest 10 years ago, with the Saudis invading the country to help crack down on people who wanted a better way of life and a little bit of democracy. And, of course, the United States supports it militarily and financially, using it as the base for the Fifth Fleet that sails the Persian Gulf instead of the American Gulf. And there are some 20,000 soldiers, sailors, and Marines there. And the Americans love this, and it puts money in the coffers. It props up the Al-Khalifa dynasty. So if this were taken away, the country would collapse, if you can call it a country. It's basically a city with some dirt around it. And there wouldn't be any more khalifas, there wouldn't be any more overcrowded prisons, there wouldn't be any more beatings, there wouldn't be any more killings. But unfortunately, nobody will do anything about it. It's like the weather. You always talk about it, but you don't do anything about it.
And let's look at the other side of the coin, Michael, because on the one hand, we have the regime, which is behaving so oppressively. On the other hand, we have, as far as those countries that they're giving this regime full support, we're talking about, especially these Western countries like the United States or like the UK. What's in it for them? Why are they supporting this repressive regime?
Well, one, of course, it's value for money. They sell weapons and other sorts of arms and ammunition and things to the khalifas to control their country. And also, it's used as a base against Iran. It's one of the many bases that the Americans have built encircling the country. And they see the Fifth Fleet sailing up and down the Persian Gulf as a way of controlling Iran and keeping Iran from exercising even a modicum amount of control in the region there, in the water. They scream bloody murder every time a couple of motorboats sail within a couple of hundred meters of an American warship. So it's again, it's money for the merchants of death, and it's control, political control, and economic control aimed at Iran.
Welcome my next guest out of London from Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, Reza, why do we not see more forceful language being used by this UN office? Now, it said it is disturbed by what has happened in the prison in Manama, but it doesn't seem to hold it responsible or demand any type of action. Your take on that?
I think one of the things that we need to recognize that the United Nations is often limited by the powers like Britain, like America, who have particular influences that they bring to bear on Bahrain and what they want to do. And so when that kind of control is there, it makes it very difficult for the United Nations officials to be able to say the things that really should be said. It's quite clear what has gone on. It is unacceptable. It is clearly problematic and so on. So there are some serious issues in terms of that need to be addressed. But this is a historical problem. This is something that has been going on in Bahrain for a number of years, where Britain would actually try to be the champion of democracy and lecture people around the world, when in fact it's ex-British police officers and MI6 agents and so on have been involved and managing the torture of people in Bahrain, anyone who rises up or says something against the government. And this is something that goes back decades in terms of how Britain has actually been playing a very dirty role on the ground, and people from official places like the MI6 or like the police and so on, or ex police officers and so on, are directly involved in managing how this is actually controlled and what actually happens on the ground in terms of the regime and legitimizing the regime and the managing when things of this ilk actually happen. So this is going back in terms of the stuff that happens for quite some time. So it's not surprising in a sense.
Well, Michael, the majority of these prisoners are political prisoners, meaning they're activists, they're former politicians, they're academics, etc. And we don't see or hear a whole lot. I mean, they're being basically incarcerated due to their beliefs. But, I mean, when we look at a situation, for example, we have a situation right now in Russia where an individual, the West is calling him a political prisoner, or it can be other places like Venezuela or Iran, and we see what they do when they talk about political prisoners. But we have these individuals and so many of them that are in Bahraini jails, but nothing is being done. Why?
Well, first off, as you mentioned, the people that are being targeted by the United States and the European Union, such as President Putin of Russia and Maduro in Venezuela and the Castros in Cuba, they want the American government wants these people overthrown. They want the legitimate government of Iran overthrown and replaced by governments friendly to the West, governments that will do the bidding of the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel. But God forbid that anyone should question the so-called allies of the United States, the organizations and countries that facilitate the operation of the American imperium around the world. Bahrain is one great example of this. Without Manama as the home port of the American Fifth Fleet, the Americans would have a substantial loss of control in the region. So they pick and they choose. They support human rights when they want to overthrow a government or gain political influence. They turn a blind eye to places like Iran and Saudi Arabia and the apartheid entity when they engage in murder, war crimes, and human rights violations because it's in their interest. They have friends. They have people that will give them influence, that will do translations and dirty work and things like this. And therefore, the Americans love that.
Well, Reza, we have witnessed protests on and off now for over a decade in Bahrain. Do you think that there has been any progress regarding human rights in that country, or has the situation deteriorated?
I think over that period of time, it would be fair to say that things have actually deteriorated quite considerably. And I think what is further telling within all of this, that while there was some kind of lip service that was being paid initially to what was going on, being unacceptable, gradually over a period of time, this has actually changed and there is indifference towards political indifference. No political will and no kind of desire to hide their indifference. And
why is that? Let me just jump in here, Reza. You said no desire to even hide their indifference. So what does that mean? Does that mean there's absolutely no accountability, not obviously inside the country and not from international entities? Your take.
Yeah, so within the country, it's even things like where you've got medical concerns of individual prisoners, and we've seen that whether it's cancer cases, whether it's the corona or issues to do with that, whether it's looking after people who have got medical conditions, all of that has been used as a weapon. So it's been weaponized to deliberately ignore those symptoms, those problems, and those issues to make sure that those people's conditions actually worsen. So it's a systematic problem. It's a systemic problem. So at any level of humanity, you know, in terms of basic humanity and human rights or humanitarian kind of issues that are raised by these things, you would have expected that there would have been an outcry regarding making sure that those people got the treatment, were treated, and had their legitimate medical needs and so on met. But there's been a systemic and systematic abuse of that within, and no kind of calling out of this on the international level by either the British government or the American government, and to not even do that is clearly a signal of what's they don't care, and they're not worried about the fact that they are seen to not care. And I think it's those kind of things that suggest that there is very little accountability of by them of the Bahraini regime and what it's doing, and also their minions in terms of British police officers that are on the ground in Bahrain managing some of these things in terms of what's actually going on, managing the publicity around this and so on and so forth. So all of these things are very much intertwined, and I think that lack of accountability on the international level is also a problem and needs to be recognized mm-hmm. and called out for what it is. I mean, they don't care, and they don't care that they are shown to not care either. And I think the solutions need to the problems in Bahrain will need to be coming from elsewhere, because if you're looking for the West to provide those solutions, it's not going to happen. They need to be coming. New thought needs to be given to that.
Okay. Well, Michael, originally protests call for political reforms through peaceful demonstrations, but the regime could not even tolerate that. So what do you make of this? And so what are the options? I mean, Reza just said that there has to be some new thought about basically help is not coming from the outside. So what needs to happen in your perspective?
Well, what needs to happen is that the United Nations has got to stop talking and wringing its hands about how things are bad there. The United States State Department's report on human rights on Bahrain for last year goes through a litany of its crimes against the people and its repression to the point where in prison you're not safe because you're beaten, you have poor medical care, and so forth. I think that short of an armed invasion of Bahrain, as the United Nations sanctioned in Korea in the early 1950s, and then in the 90s in Yugoslavia and in Iraq, nothing's going to be done. You've got to point out exactly what's happening. You've got to get the international news media to break their ties with government and point out exactly what is being done to the people of Bahrain by the American-supported government, by the British-supported government. And we've got to really point the finger and publicize this. Certainly publicizing what went on in South Africa brought an end to apartheid. And if you could get the news media to do the same thing in Israel or the same thing with Bahrain, it might be another story, but that's a big task, and you've got to persuade these corporate giants that it's in their interest to report the news factually and carefully and accurately.
Well, Reza, Sheikh Isa Qasim, the main religious leader, of course, of Bahrain, says a new constitution is the only way to end the repression in that country. Your take on that, and what would it take for that happen?
I think in terms of the new constitution and so on, I can't see the Bahraini authorities agreeing to that, because that would mean limiting the powers that the king would have, the limiting the powers that would be had in order to continue the oppression that they are doing in terms of meeting the needs and the aspirations of the Bahraini people. So while this is a legitimate demand, and I think it's appropriate that something like this is instigated and done and provides an alternative about what the way forward could be, and it says very clearly to people looking into Bahrain internationally that, look, there are solutions on the ground that are legitimate, that are valid, and all of those things are there, I think it's very appropriate that something like that is happening. But at the same time, don't hold your breath that this is going to be something that's going to be, they're going to roll over and allow that to be done and the new constitution to be brought in, because it will be, to, you know, which oppressor would like their powers to be limited in any way which person, megalomaniac, is going to want to have their powers limited. And that's simply not going to happen. And
so you said that another thought process... Sorry to interrupt you, I'm just so limited in time, but you said another thought process, Reza, has to be taken into consideration. Because as I said earlier, repeating what you said, that the help is not going to come from those Western powers or the so-called international agency that's supposed to be dealing with human rights. So what's the answer in your perspective? What has to be done?
So I think it's a multitude of things that need to happen. I mean, if there are people sitting outside, I mean, it's looking at grassroots, it's looking at institutional links with Bahrain. So whether it's academic, whether it's on the sporting field, whether it's any of those kind of things that can, so whether it's Formula One that goes there, targeting those people and those kind of things to actually say, you need to rein back, you need to pull out, because this, you, what you're doing is supporting a regime which is oppressive, and so on and so forth. So I think at one level, it's got to be that. At the grassroots level within Bahrain, we need to think about, you know, it's like any oppressive system or any oppressive government. Are they going to roll over? They're not, unless you give them and make them an offer and provide them the resistance that is required to make them realize that an alternative offer is actually worthwhile in terms of taking. And think about how that resistance needs to be manifested. So that there is one level in terms of demonstrations, in terms of all of these things that are going to be taking place on the ground, and they have been happening for years and decades in some senses, in terms of what's been going on. Obviously, with the whole 2011 and where it started, there was an intensity that was created after that period of time that it was going on for. But I think obviously all of these things will continue, but I think another angle in terms of whether looking at resistance in a different kind of form might be an option that needs to be looked at. So I think that I would say that people need to look at those options, and when those options are on the table, the government will start to think, okay, is it really going to be worth my while to take on a resistance that is going to be much more assertive and aggressive in what they do?
Okay, and on that note, appreciate you being with us, both of you, actually. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Always a pleasure, Michael, and Islamic Human Rights Commission. Reza Kazem out of London, thank you so much. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and its purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. If you have been listening to this series of shows, we are trying to talk about the last savior, Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and different doubts or misconceptions around this important topic. In recent shows, we have been trying to approach the doubts or misconceptions raised by a so-called scholar from extremist groups to make some serious doubts in the issue of occultation and in the issue of birth of Imam of the Age and different actually aspects of the life and personality and mission of Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In this very show, we shall focus on the doubt that he actually made on the traditions or narrations of occultation that, based on what he says, there are some contradictions in these series of narrations. So this is what we shall discuss today with presence of Islamic scholars and researchers from Qom Samiri School. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic researcher, to this show, and we'll be asking him to answer the questions that we pose or the to review whatever has been said and claimed and to have his own take on this. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to say salam to Sheikh and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam and thank you for having me. I was born in 1981 and I joined the Hausa Seminary of Qom in 1994, so it's about 25 years that I'm studying the Hausa Seminary of Qom. And beside fiqh and usul, or jurisprudence and the principles of jurisprudence, I have studied logic, Arabic literature and grammar, Islamic philosophy, and more importantly, Islamic theology. I also have my BA in Islamic theology from Imam Khomeini Institute for Education and Research in Qom. And then I continued my education on monotheistic religions. I mean, I had my MA in this field from the University of Religions and Islamic Denominations. And I have my PhD in Shia theology from University of Tehran. My PhD was about an analysis of the viewpoint of one of the false claimants with regards to the knowledge of the Imam.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day, again, is another doubt or misconception raised by a so-called Wahhabi scholar on the concept of Mahdawi or Mahdism, and specifically the concept of intidhar or the concept of ghibah, occultation. The doubt says that why Mahdi alayhi salam did not appear at the time of a Shia government, which were settled and established after the occultation, like that of Safavids, and even he names the Islamic Republic of Iran, where the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam actually is running the government, is running the whole country. He says that in case the concept of occultation and intidhar and expectation of the last savior is true, why doesn't he reappear at the time that the majority of the people are with him and the current is actually backing him in case he reappears? I think the question can be answered, Sheikh, very simply if anyone is to some extent familiar with the concept of occultation and the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam in this regard. But since we want to approach it scientifically from your own words, we are looking forward to hearing from you, Sheikh.
He also adds something to what you mentioned. He says that you Shia claim that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he went into occultation. One of the reasons was that his life was in danger. So he says that if this is the case, at the time of Buyids or Buwahids or the Buye, the power was in the hands of these people, and they were Shia, and so at least Mahdi was able to reappear at that time and to use the wealth and power of the Buyids. And maybe after, when they diminish, they lose their power,